You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. So just before we get started, I wanted to let you know that I'm hosting the first live episode of The Compass. It's going to be on Sunday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at Arts on Site, a great nonprofit art space on St. Mark's in the East Village. My guests are going to be my lovely husband, actor Frankie J. Alvarez, and actress and singer-songwriter Laura Gratmans. It's a $10 suggested donation at the door. If you'd like to come, please email me at thecompasslive@gmail.com. I'm going to make a reserved list of the first 50 people who RSVP. If you can't get on the list, just show up on the night of and we'll try to fit as many people as we can in. Also, if you do reserve a spot and end up changing your plans before the night of, just let me know so I can get some other people on the list. More information on the Facebook page, but I hope to see you there. It should be a lot of fun. My guest today is Jason Gray Platt. Jason is a wonderful playwright who I had the good fortune of meeting through a dear friend a few years ago. I'm honored he shared his thoughts with me. He is delightful. And I hope you enjoy the 50th episode of The Compass. So how do you try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist? Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, you get caught in these cycles where you're just telling yourself over and over again, like, oh, you have no talent, you're like a worthless piece of shit. And it's kind of like, you know, in a very exacerbated way, like walking a path through a garden, and it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper over again, like neurologically, until you're so deep into this path, into this rut, that you can't even see over the edge, and you're like, okay, how do I climb back out over the edge? And usually the most effective thing for me is to turn to art. I read a lot of poetry, or I go to museums, and just try to immerse myself in something that is beautiful and has meaning, and it's like, oh, okay, there are good things in the world, maybe I can contribute to that. I've also been in analysis for the last few years, which has been incredibly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very supportive partner, which is incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
I think it's really hard when you do the work that we do, I mean, probably for anybody, to both be in a very uncertain place professionally and also to not have a very stable personal life. And you sort of hope that in your life you'll get one or the other. But to have somebody you can go home to, and, you know, because I am with somebody who has a history of also working in the theater and the creative world, she understands in a really great way and is able to offer advice that is helpful and things like that. But yeah, but it's a problem. I get compulsive and obsessive about the dark place a lot.
Yeah. Have you found that you've gotten better at realizing, like, you still go there, but maybe maybe you spend less and less time?
I spend less time there for sure. And, you know, when the sort of obsessive thoughts come up, I now sort of know why they're there and where they come from. And I can say to myself, like, oh, yeah, this, again, I've thought about this.
Right.
And it still takes a while to get out, but it's not as debilitating in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, the worst thing that can happen is that it just stops you from working, and you go to a place of kind of anhedonia of, like, I don't care anymore. You know, none of this matters. Nothing.
It's kind of static.
Yeah. And the only thing that really brings you out of it is to just keep working.
Yeah.
You know, eventually, hopefully, it'll release.
I was curious about this. I was thinking about it earlier before you came over, that especially for a writer, when it is such a singular activity, I assume there's some isolation involved that might, you know, be really enjoyable in some ways, but also contribute to the dark place.
It's a double-edged sword. You know, there's times when I think to myself, I kind of wish I was a novelist or a poet, and then I could live in a cabin in the woods and never have to deal with any people ever again. But also, at the same time, you know, you write the play, great, but it's not even, until people have read it, until it's changed, like, it's nothing, in a way. In the same way that,
right.
You know, if you wrote poetry or you wrote fiction, obviously you wanted the people to experience it, but it's closer to being finished in a way that a piece of theater is not. And so, to then be alone with this thing where you need other people, is like, oh, now what do I do? You know.
Right, yeah, right,
so
right.
It can be both sides.
Do you find, like, reaching out to people to have a reading just so you can hear it, like, is that ever something that's helpful to take you out of it and you feel like that's a resource I can reach for right now? Or is it, like, feeling like it's not finished, I don't want to share it.
I don't
want them to judge it, since I know it's not there yet, but I need input.
Yeah, the judging part is less of a problem for me because I have enough friends who are performers who I trust, you know, to do the work. The bigger problem for me is I know that I'm basically asking friends to, like, give up their time to help me develop this thing, and I'm very sensitive to, as I you know, so all we all being young in our field, it's like, oh, we all do this stuff and we don't get paid and we give up so much of our time. And so I try not to ask the same people over and over again. I try to only ask if it's in, like, a really, it's ready to be done. It's also a lot about, like, my own personal stuff about, like, not wanting to bother or burden people.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, it's a serious thing for us because, you know, as a performer, I'm sure you've had the same thing of, like, you know, people ask you to read things and you're working, right? That's your job, that's your craft, but you're not getting paid for it.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just a delicate thing to navigate.
I know you've participated in a lot of these different, like, workshops and things, and, like, we kind of met through Rachel, but also through friends at the New Harmony Project mm-hmm. and stuff like that. How does being engaged in, like, that kind of communal focus on your work, how does that work for you? Do you enjoy that kind of focused?
Yeah, New Harmony Project was, in particular, fantastic. Having, you know, there's a lot of programs that are sort of 2 weeks-ish, like the O'Neill Bay Area Playwrights Festival, Sundance All Around, where you can get it up on its feet and have time to rewrite and do a couple of readings and then go back and do some more rewrites is, like, immensely helpful. You know, it reminds me of when I was in grad school and had those opportunities because I went to Columbia, so there was a directing program and an acting program, and they, at least at that time, really encouraged a lot of cross-pollination for you to work with one another. And so, you know, it gives you insights that you won't get just from sitting there and reading it by yourself. And even, you know, a cold reading, because to be able to have actors spend a lot of, you know, multiple hours with the piece and to have a director who can, you know, speak to things in a way that I can't speak to things because I don't have that skill set, is just incredibly helpful. New Harmony was amazing. Yeah.
How did you start writing? Did you kind of always gear towards playwriting, or how did that happen for you?
No, I wrote ever since I was a kid, like very, very young. But I wrote fiction and short stories, and I was a huge Agatha Christie fan. Like, I read, like, all the Hercule Poirot novels when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And so, of course, I wrote my own little murder mystery at one point. And then I was in high school, my senior year of high school, and I fell in love with this young woman
mm-hmm.
who was an actress. And she knew I was a writer, and she said, oh, well, you know, why don't you write me a play? And I was like, I'll do whatever you want to. And I did, and it was awful. It was so bad. It was the prototypical first play about someone who was in love with someone who didn't like them back. And so the act break is like they try to commit suicide, and, you know, it was terrible.
So you wrote Romeo and Juliet.
I wrote Romeo and Juliet.
Perfect.
All my best thoughts were stolen by the ancients. but, it, you know, there was something about it that just clicked. You know, you have those moments in life where it sort of feels like the concrete has just set in a way, and then you can build on it.
Hmm.
And even though, I mean, I'm sure at the time I thought it was amazing, it was like, oh, there's something here that I have not experienced before. So I kept doing it. And I had already basically planned to go to Vassar, where I went for undergrad, because they have a really great creative writing program in the English department. And it just, out of complete happenstance, they also have a fantastic student theater sort of world. And I started doing things in the EJAR program, and I just kept writing it. And I never went back. And now I probably couldn't write a short story if you put a gun to my head.
How does your family, like, react to you being an artist? Have they always been supportive of that choice?
They've been amazingly supportive. Actually, what happened was my senior year of college, my whole life I was sort of just, it was the default that I would be an attorney. My parents are both attorneys.
I see. Family business.
Everybody. And I had not even thought about it. It was just like, okay, this is what I, you know, we used to watch Law and Order, like, for fun.
And you're an only child.
I have much older brother and sister.
Okay.
And so my senior year of college, I was like, well, you know what? I'll apply to a bunch of law schools, apply to a bunch of playwriting schools, and we'll just see what happens. And I got waitlisted at playwriting schools but didn't get in, and got into a few law schools. So I was like, all right, you know what? I'll be a lawyer. So I was going to go to law school in Virginia.
Okay.
I had my corral assigned in the library. I had my dorm room all set up. And I was literally, it was like the middle of August, and my parents and I were trying to decide how to get, like, when I drive across country, when I ship my car out there, what to do. And they both said, you know, you don't seem very excited about it. And I sort of thought about it, and I was like, you know, I guess I'm not super excited about it. And they were the ones who really told me, they're like, you know, if you don't want to do this, don't do it. You know, don't just do it because it's the thing that you always thought you were going to do. And so I was like, all right, screw it. And so I moved to New York. I had met Jeffrey Jackson Scott, who at that time was working at New York Theater Workshop at Vassar when they were doing a workshop there. And he was like, hey, do you want to be a literary intern? I was like, sure, I'll do that. I'll work at, I was working at Barnes & Noble, you know, scrap. And so I was just like, I'll do it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they, and, you know, my parents, I think, both come from backgrounds where they, all they wanted for their children was, like, for them to be, for my parents to be successful and then, like, their kids to be happy. You know, and so they don't really care that what I'm doing, as long as it's fulfilling and satisfying. And it's also so different from what they do that they, I think, have a much more respect for it than they probably should. In a way. Because it's so, you know, it's just so foreign to their world. And now, you know, they never saw theater, so now, you know, they see a lot of theater and they, mm-hmm. sort of, they actively try to engage with what I do.
That's really wonderful.
It's wonderful. I appreciate it so much. But sometimes they're really proud of me for, like, things that I'm like, that's not, don't worry about it.
Thank you, but...
but I'll take it.
Aw. Yeah. That's really amazing to have that support system.
I'm very fortunate for that.
Yeah. What sort of collaborative relationships have you built over your time in New York that you find are shaping what you're doing now, or the people that you met right maybe right when you moved here that are still involved in your work? Because I think that's fascinating, with like playwrights and directors who find each other, or a playwright and an actor who have this connection.
I've been very fortunate also in that, because the first person I ever met, so I got this internship at the New York Theater Workshop, and I started as soon as I got here, and the first person, like my first New York friend, was this young woman, Jessica Fish, who's a director. She now lives in Chicago. But, you know, we were, like, in the crucible of being interns together in this big theater.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she was like, oh, show me a play. I showed her a play. We started working together. And now we've been working together for a decade, even though she, you know, we're in different cities. So that's been really great. And then I went to grad school eventually only a year after I got out of college, which in retrospect it was probably too soon.
Hmm.
But I did... also have a lot of lasting relationships that have come out of that. A director, Michael Tara Garver, who I'm very close with and work a lot with, dramaturg Jeremiah Davis, you know, a lot of people. And my relationships from Vassar have been fortunate too, because I'm in a theater company called Woodshed Collective,
mm-hmm.
that was originally started by a group of people at Vassar and then sort of exported it to the city. And so most of the people I work with, I've known for like 8 or 9 years at this point or more.
Have you been involved with the Woodshed Collective like since it was started, or
I wasn't
just
at
recently?
College. And then around, and I wasn't originally in the city, I think 2013-ish, there was a sort of merging of sort of two groups of people in the collective. And I went, Michael Tara Garver went, a number of other artists, some Columbia people, and that's sort of when I joined as well.
I know you did, I want to hear about that project you did with them last year,
Empire, yeah.
Yeah, the travel agency one, because I didn't get to see it because it was such a small audience, but I think it's so cool, and I want to hear about how you guys came up with it and developed it.
You know, it's the small audience thing was both what it had to be for the show to work, but also incredibly frustrating in so many ways, because so few people got to see it. And what, you know, most of what Woodshed does are big installations in which, you know, they take over warehouses or old churches, and the audiences are 100 people a night, and you're just sort of walking through the space. So that was a shift. But the way we came up with it was, we tried to do the sort of immersive equivalent of a New Works Festival the year before, and so we were sort of just like trying out a lot of different methodologies for immersive work. So we had one where there was a show that was like in a car, and you got picked up in a car, and this little scene happened. We had one that was on the F train to Coney Island.
Would you see all of these in succession, or
no,
just like whatever day you were on? Okay.
Yeah. And there were a couple of others, and then we were like, all right, so what worked here and what was interesting to us? And so once we sort of decided what the methodologies were that were interesting, we came up with this narrative of this sort of secret organization. I basically refer to it as like if Thomas Pynchon had written an Indiana Jones movie. It's like this secret organization that has controlled something in the water that decides where the empires have been in the history of the world.
Mm.
And now it has been in New York, and somebody's like trying to take it away and all this stuff. And then, you know, one of the other big things about our shows is where it's going to happen, because they're all site-specific. And so we were talking to New York City, and the city had a space in South Street Seaport that had been empty since Sandy. It had been just, like, totally devastated. And it's now slated, I think they're going to eventually turn it into a huge hotel, like a boutique hotel.
Mm-hmm.
But for the past few years, it's been just sort of sitting there. And they said, like, well, yeah, I mean, if you can put electricity in and you can put in plumbing, like, by all means.
Uh-huh.
And so we took over 4 or 5 rooms in this huge building at South Street Seaport.
Just for this show?
Just for the show, basically. And then it started at a payphone in the financial district, and then you went on a car, and then you went on a train, and you were walking all around, and eventually sort of home base was this building, and the last, you know, 30 minutes or so sort of took place there. And yeah, that's what it was.
Oh, see, I didn't realize that it went to many different locations. I just remember you saying that it took place in a car.
Yeah.
And that was why, like, it was such limited tickets and all of that.
That was the thing, is about, well, there's two sections when you're in a car.
Mm-hmm.
And so in total, probably 15 to 20 minutes of it is that. And so we could only do 4 people per show. And we did 3 shows a night. So it was like 12 people a night.
Right.
Which is just insanity. And the other thing is that, you know, all of our work is free. We try to make it free.
Amazing.
And so because of that, demand is much higher than it would be for, you know, a show that you're charging $150
for. Right, right, right. Yeah. So how many shows did you end up doing total?
That's a good question. We ran it for about, I want to say a month, maybe a month and a half.
Okay.
3 shows a night. So yeah, I think we got a few hundred people through.
That's really amazing.
Yeah.
So how do you guys deal with, like, the financial side of it, if you're striving to provide free experiences, but you gotta get plumbing and electricity?
Yeah. We have a lot of both private and foundation government support. And then, you know, the other part of it is, and I think this is true with a lot of immersive companies that I've noticed, is you always have a bar.
Yes,
you know?
That is helpful.
On the one hand, because people like to drink, but also that's, you know, it's a great way to make some money. And we worked it in so that it was like part of the experience at one point, because this elixir was called Ambrose. So you could like have some.
Okay. Interesting.
But yeah, it is a difficult part of it.
Yeah. Sure. Are you involved a lot in that kind of producing side of it when you're working with them, or are you just, you're the writer?
I'm the business manager for Woodshed.
Oh, okay.
I also,
so a lot.
My side gig for my life is I'm a bookkeeper for various sort of arts organizations.
Okay.
So I deal with it on the back end. I'm not in charge of talking to people or getting money. But, you know, our show for 2017, I won't be too specific in case it doesn't happen, but it's a co-production with one really big theater organization, and one sort of a little bit smaller organization. But, you know, part of it is that it's going to be a huge scale thing, and it's not something that we could do by ourselves. You know, we just couldn't raise that money. And I think, you know, that's also something that a lot of theaters doing right now, co-productions, to share the costs. It's the sort of the financial climate that we're in right now. It's tight.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, I was going to ask you about how you kind of patchwork together your income between or with writing stuff. So how did bookkeeping come into it?
It happened totally by happenstance. When I graduated from grad school, I got a job at the Ooster Group.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the administrator there for about 2.5 years. And so the entire office staff, at least at that point, was like 4 people. And so I was in charge of the accounting and insurance, all the sort of bookkeeping stuff and a lot of other, you know, day-to-day things, office supplies. And I had very little experience in the sort of necessary, like, I didn't know how to use QuickBooks.
Yeah.
You know, I've used financial software. I do it for myself, but sort of the real, like, business QuickBooks, no idea.
Yeah.
But I think they liked me, and they thought I would be a good fit. And at the end of the day, you actually do pick it up pretty quickly. It's something you can learn on the job pretty fast. And so when I left, I amazingly had this very useful skill set.
That's really incredible.
And so I've continued to do it for, I've been doing it for Woodshed for a long time, for Space on Rider Farm.
Okay.
For a few years. And so it's a very nice day job because it's a few days a week. It's usually very flexible. A lot of it is virtual. And so it's sort of the perfect fit.
And you're still working to support other artistic organizations, yeah, which is nice, you know.
I'm mainly working with theater organizations, so it's something, it's a world that I know, sort of understand what they mean when they're like, oh yeah, we had a reading.
Right.
It's like, oh, I know what that is. So that's been the primary. And then, you know, you cobble together fellowships and things here and there. I also do industrials from time to time. I'm doing it's called the, I'm writing something for the Future of Storytelling Festival, which is taking place in October. A colleague of mine from Woodshed and I are doing sort of like pop-up theater things. Oh. So things like that. I worked for AMC Networks a few years ago when they did their upfronts and they had a big immersive experience. And so, yeah, you just sort of do what you can.
Yeah. Do you feel like, did they do a good job of like in grad school, like teaching you about, because I, as a ignorant actor, don't actually know that much about the business part of it for playwrights, like about, oh, well, if you get a commission, you get this, and then, but then later, when the play's actually finished, you get this cut, and that you need to be conscious of this, and like...
No, I know nothing about any of that.
Yeah, me either.
That's a great question. No, we didn't, there were no sort of dedicated business classes or financial classes, and it's an interesting question as to whether that should be part of the...
Yeah, no, it's because true.
Part of you says, like, oh, well, yeah, of course, like, this is your profession.
Right. Why would you not, like, had a cobbled together businessy classes at Juilliard our last year, and mm-hmm. somebody told us, like, what you should be keeping track of for taxes.
But no, that's right. Like, the tax stuff is very helpful, mm-hmm. right? Because that's a really gray, murky area, I think, for a lot of artists, of, like, okay, what can I expense? And also, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth. Recently, there was a decision in the Supreme Court about what you get to constitute as a occupation, whether or not you're making the majority of your income based on something.
That's tricky.
It was a woman who, I hope I'm recalling this right, as a painter. I mean, she has pieces like in MoMA in their collections, but she hadn't been making recently a lot of money from her work. And yet she was saying, oh, she was a painter, she was deducting all of these things. And the IRS was like, no, you're not a painter. And at a certain point, it's like, okay, why does the state get to decide who I am, what my job is? You know, and this is capitalism. But so they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was like, no, she has pieces in MoMA. She's a painter, right? And so it's going to have a huge effect, I think, on sort of what artists get to do. I hope I didn't...
This was recently. This was recently.
This was, I think, within the last year, a year and a half.
Okay, I'm going to look that up.
But it's difficult.
Yeah, it's so murky.
There was a series in Dramatist magazine this past year, which is like the playwriting magazine, for the Dramatist Guild, about taxes,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about, it was a transcription of a, I think at a conference they had been talking about it, and they happened to have a lawyer at the conference who was like, you know, not representing the argument of a private attorney, but was saying what their perspective was, and he was saying that there are lots and lots of people in the world, in America, I'm sure this is true, who are like, oh yeah, my hobby is private jets, or, you know, or I have a hobby that is like collecting horses. Or they'll say that that's what I love. And so tax IRS auditors are like, okay, what is your hobby and what is your profession? And if you try to claim that, like, oh, I'm a professional old car collector, and so I'm going to write off these $50,000 cars.
Yeah, Jay Leno.
Right? Thanks, Jay Leno. Ruined it for all of us. So they're very skeptical. You know, as I guess if you put yourself in their shoes, of course you would be, because lots of people try to cheat their taxes. But, you know, based on what I was reading in this article, the process of proving to them that you are an artist by profession is incredibly onerous because they are understaffed, the IRS. And so you end up having to write this long, like, narrative about your entire year of, like, these are all the people that I met with, and these are all the things that I did, and you have to send it to them because they don't have enough staff to just sort of sit down and talk to you and be like, okay, so tell me.
It's also, you wonder how much imagination they have, because it really is, what we do is hard to understand. It's hard to describe to someone, just as if I was in a world where me and all of my friends were lawyers, I would understand everything about that world, but as I am who I am, I don't.
Right, it's true.
So you hope that those people
they,
at the IRS are trained to put themselves in other people's shoes, yeah, and give them the benefit of the doubt.
One of the playwrights who was in this article was saying that her tax attorney essentially like just printed out 15 of her plays and like sent them to the IRS and like put them on the desk. It's like, that seems like the best option. Just flood them with paper and they'll be like, okay.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful option. So where are you at this moment with New York City? Are you sticking it out?
I don't know. It's been a decade. This is like my decade mark. Mm-hmm. And my family lives in California. And I've now been back east because I went to undergrad back east for almost 15 years, which is almost half of my life.
And you grew up in California
I grew up in Arizona and then in California, okay. So like west. And I would like to be closer to my family. And part of that, of course, is that, you know, TV is part of what you're thinking about when you're a playwright and you're a writer and sort of what you want to do with your life. And I'm trying to do some more of that. My partner is currently at a fellowship at a hospital in Boston that will be up in June. And part of the discussion will be where she has job opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I have talked about, you know, potentially L.A. or Denver. Also, my brother lives in Boulder, which I think is just gorgeous. But it's something that we're looking at. And it's, you know, it's hard to say because I wouldn't say that I've exhausted New York's possibilities. There's so much in New York, how could you exhaust it? But it's also, no matter where you are in your life at a certain point, I think you just want to try something else and move on. And so L.A., I think, beckons.
I mean, that's amazing that it's also close to your family. So you could kind of, you know,
her two things at once. In Texas, so mm-hmm. it's close-ish to them. It's not super close. But I think it would be positive in ways that are not just about my career as well.
Yeah.
I think raising a child in New York is hard, mostly because the school thing is just so, it's just absurd.
I know.
The private schools, the competition, the money, it's just outrageous. And so the idea of that just boggles the mind, really.
Yeah. Jason, just for the listener, Jason's partner, Rachel Rush, was on a previous episode. I don't remember the number right now, but it's amazing.
Number one
in Jason's heart. So go back and listen to that. She's great. So, yeah, I was going to ask you about the TV stuff, because I know, I mean, it's one way to make money as actors or writers.
It is. It's such an interesting time right now.
There's a lot of good TV.
And also just sort of the question of where media is going and what it's going to become. You know, is cable going to break up? Are they going to unbundle all of these channels? And is it going to be the demise of cable?
Everything's online.
Everything's online. Is it all going to move to apps? Is it all going to move to content platforms like Netflix and Hulu? Like, these are just fascinating questions. And it's good. You know, it's very good. And you can do things in television that you can't do in theater. Of course, you can do things in theater, you can't do television. But the idea of getting to spend potentially 100 hours with an audience, with those characters, with those stories, you know, you can tell a story in depth in a way that you can't in theater. And in you know, potentially a very like nuanced, complicated way.
Have you already worked in that format or screenwriting format, or are you just starting to dabble in it?
I've just started, you know, I've been writing pilots and I've been going out and taking meetings in LA and meeting the studios and producers. And I haven't started sort of working on a show yet. I think part of that also is like, if I'm in LA, it will make it much easier for that sort of
Of course. But I mean, like, just for you to even to sit down and be like, okay, what do I need to change in my brain if I'm going to work today on writing something for screen instead of stage?
It's very different. I think the main difference for me is that, and you know, this might just be a personal thing, but when you're working on a screenplay on television in particular, you pretty much outline the whole thing, right? You do the beat sheet, you know, like, what's act one, act two, act three, act four, what goes where, and I, you know, you have the index card, you put them on the place.
Right.
When I'm writing a play, I have some idea of where it's going. I know who the characters are, but I just sort of start writing, and where it ends up going, you know, who could say? Which you can't really do in television, you know, primarily because you're spending someone else's money,
mm-hmm.
and they want to know what's going to happen, as you know, it's totally understandable. And in particular, because if you're writing a multi-episode season, then you have to have all of these things. You know, you can't just sort of like, all right, we'll see what happens.
If you use all your good twists and turns in the first season,
there's
nowhere.
So many moving pieces.
Nowhere to go.
And both of those are very different experiences and satisfying in different ways, I would say. Yeah.
And also, I'm sure it'll be interesting to find out, like, working within a writer's room, too. Because I know people end up taking on individual episodes or being the lead writer on individual episodes, but you're also accountable to these other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, it's an interesting thing.
Which is maybe why playwrights are so well suited. So many playwrights I know from Juilliard are going out there, because they're used to collaborating.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, directors.
You take feedback from your directors, you go on with your actors. And it's actually very helpful in a way.
Do you find that really exciting, that point of when rehearsals start or you're done rewriting and you're handing over your child to a group of actors and a director?
I don't know what that means.
Mostly done rewriting. Like, I always wonder, it must be a thin line between, like, so excited to see what they can add to it and also, like, terrified that they're not going to do it the way you pictured it.
It is.
You know?
So the first day of rehearsal is, I don't know what it is. It's like you found out the day you're going to die. And so on the one hand, it's, like, really depressing, but you're also like, okay, good. Now this pressure is lifted and I can do whatever I want.
It's your turn.
It is. You know, it's funny because it's hard to talk about it without sounding kind of, like, selfish and arrogant. But in your mind, of course, you're like, oh, I see it this way. Why aren't people doing it this way?
Right.
And it takes a while to get used to the fact that just because they're not doing it the way that you see it doesn't mean it's not working. It actually might be better, you know, because we all have tunnel vision about these things to a certain extent. And it gets, you know, it gets very exciting when discoveries start being made in the room and you're like, oh, I had no idea. You know, primarily because it's impossible for you to see everything that you're doing. And there's so much stuff happening in your subconscious that's, like, on the page. But you're like, oh, God, I didn't even know. How did
right.
they know? They figured it
and
out.
And it's from your point of view, obviously.
Exactly. So it becomes like a little treasure hunt.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. That must be really exciting. Especially when it's, like, opening night of a play and you get to sit in the back of the house and watch.
Ooh, that's the worst. it took me so many years to be able to do that without just being so drunk. I just couldn't get through it. Have you had experiences with playwrights who you can tell that they're, like, not happy with the way that you're doing something, but they won't maybe say it?
You know, I don't know if I've had as much experience, like, fully producing new work as I would like. So I'm not thinking about anything off the top of my head.
That's very diplomatic.
It's gonna, I'm sure I will at some point. I'm sure I will at some point. Oh, this is just a big question on this podcast, but where are you with, like, the struggle to define what success is in a healthy way in your life? Like, it, you know, in an ideal world, I think we'd all love to be like, oh, well, success is blank. You're getting paid millions of dollars. But I don't think that's not a healthy definition of success, since it's not something that 99% of us will ever get.
True.
So there's, like, this balance between celebrating your wins, mm-hmm. but you can't put everything into that, or you're going to be sad the other 80% of the time.
I'm in a transitional place with that.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with my psychoanalysis. but yeah, I think I was raised by parents who were very hard workers and who were very successful. And I think I internalized that work ethic and also the assumption that if you work hard enough and if you are good enough, you will be successful. Right, there's, like, no, it'll happen, right? The world works that way. And of course that's not the case. I mean, certainly not in a in a winner take all economy like the arts, where there's very
right.
few racist people and everybody else is
or at least
well.
Not in a direct
yeah.
line.
And so that was where a lot of my, you know, where the dark place came from. It's like, oh, if I'm not getting published, if I'm not getting produced, that means that A, I'm either not talented, I'm not working hard enough, or that, like, I'm just a bad person, right? Something's wrong with
right.
me personally. And I work very hard, and so the only thing I could imagine was that, like, oh, I'm just not very talented. I'm just not a good writer.
Right.
And all of this, you know, is sort of like the end point of the sort of capitalist ethos we live in, which is like, oh, well, if you're not making a lot of money, then you are worthless, right?
Right.
And to a certain extent, the two, I mean, you know, success as a writer or as an artist in general, you want to say is being able to share your work. And that might not necessarily come in conjunction with making lots of money, it often doesn't. But mm-hmm. also sometimes you don't even have the chance to share your work, or sharing your work, certainly in theater, requires having some money in a way that, like, if you're a poet, you can just maybe email someone. you have to get to a place where many artists say they have gotten, I don't quite believe them, but it's nice that they say it, where just doing the work is the reward. Now, I don't think it's ever going to be all of the reward. I think
right.
It's impossible, but it has to be 75 to 80% of it, of just like, oh, I actually write because I really enjoy writing. And there's a part of me that's just, you know, creating other worlds, working things out in my head and getting those things on paper is incredibly fulfilling and exciting to me. And that's all very true. And I have to stop putting 90% of the importance and the focus on the last 20%, which is like, well, who's going to do this?
Someone else giving you the
yeah.
the check, the check mark.
That's very hard. I think, you know, a lot of it's cultural. A lot of it's simply about, you know, the adulation you get when you're on stage and you're being applauded, or you're sitting in the back watching your own play. And those things are so much more viscerally rewarding in a way. That, you know, I think part of it is like neurological, like, where's my serotonin?
Why, right. You know, where's it and you do want to enjoy those moments when they happen, but absolutely. it can't be the only thing.
Yeah. I think of, I feel like that, you know, dude bringing up David Foster Wallace, but there was, you know, David Foster Wallace talked about when Infinite Jest came out and the trap you get into of reviews and people liking your work, because on the one hand, if you don't want to get upset when people don't like your work, right? But that means you also can't really enjoy it when people like your work, because either other people matter or they don't matter, right? And so you have to find a way to maintain this very even keel. And I think, I think we've all seen this, that people, when they get rejection, artists sort of go into two camps. There's like the grandiose camp of like, nobody understands me, why don't I get my chance, I'm a genius. And then there's the depressive camp of like, oh my god, I'm terrible and worthless, I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's somewhere in the middle. Because on the one hand, you know, there are so many things outside of your control about your work that you have there's no way you can influence them. This is just impossible. And so, to a certain extent, you can be grandiose and be like, why is no, you know, I just, there's nothing I can do. People aren't giving me a shot. But it's also probably true that, like, yeah, you know what, maybe I could have done another revision. Maybe I could have worked a little bit harder. But it's about maintaining a healthy balance of those two things. And knowing that, you know, in the end, if you don't love the fact that you're doing it without getting adulation, without getting published, then why are you doing it? You know, are you just doing it as a substitute for love?
Yeah, totally. What do you do outside of writing that you find some sort of like creative outlet in? Do you have any hobbies? God. Other art forms I don't know about?
I
or
have hobbies.
Cooking?
I'm a terrible cook. I read a lot,
mm-hmm.
like nonfiction, fiction, poetry. Like I love reading. Big museum junkie, film. But I should do more.
What are some of your favorite museums in New York?
I love the Cooper Hewitt. I have the Design Museum. They have like, such interesting stuff there. Love the MoMA, Frick, you know, all the big ones. Guggenheim always has interesting things. Yeah. All the ones that people already know about, I'm not helping anybody at all. when I was a kid, I played a lot of sports.
Uh-huh.
I played competitive tennis when I was a child, and I played a lot of soccer, and I miss that. You know, I miss not only the athletics of it, but sort of the community of it.
Yeah.
And it's something that's like not art. It's physical and it's you know, mindless, not in the negative sense, but in the sense of like you are not self-conscious in a way because you're just executing. It can be really wonderful. Like it's almost like a kind of meditation.
Right. You just have to rely on your instincts.
Yeah. It's just all.
Or your reflexes.
Yeah. Body memory. I miss that a lot.
Do you watch a lot of sports?
All
are you
time.
Into that? Yeah.
All the time.
See, Frankie has that too, and I'm very like scornful of it in some ways because it's just not a part of my life. But I do wish I had been on a soccer team when I was a kid, or like
the communal
part of like Sunday football.
Absolutely. I went to go see the Wolves at the Playwrights Realm, which is fabulous. And if it's still playing when this comes out, people should go see it. And it's about a young woman's soccer team, and they're like 16, like juniors in high school. And it took me back. You just like immediately to all those days on the field. It's so good, and it was really warm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took me to this place. It's like, oh, I miss that.
I mean, I guess that's a similar thing of, like, I grew up doing theater, so that was my communal activity, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's another downside of living in New York is that's harder.
Yeah.
If you want to play tennis, for the tennis courts are few and far between and expensive.
Expensive.
You know, it's hard to get big fields and things together. I miss that, too.
Yeah. Well, we just kind of talked about this a little bit, but on those days where you really are feeling, like, in the dark side, depressed, uninspired, like, are there concrete things that you reach for again and again, like a specific book or an album you listen to or someone you call?
No, I wouldn't say specifics. I go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
That's very helpful. Walt Whitman is a big help. Leaves of Grass always gets me back, gets me going. I recently was rereading Stephen King's On Writing.
I just read it for the first time.
Yeah.
So good, because someone else had recommended it.
Yeah, it has a lot of just really concrete advice. And sometimes, you know, it sounds so silly, but Laurie Moore's Bird by Bird is good for this too. Is it Laurie Moore? No. Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, sorry.
So okay.
Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird.
Uh-huh.
And Stephen King's On Writing, they're books that literally they say at one point, like, you have permission. Go be imaginative. Go spend your time daydreaming and staring out the window and, you know, just thinking about stuff. And I never felt like I had that permission. The other part of it for me is, like, I have a hard time thinking that if I'm not literally doing some kind of physical labor, even if it's writing down things on a page, I'm not working. Daydreaming doesn't feel like work to me, and that's a problem, because it is, right? Like,
80%
of writing is just, like, thinking about stuff and watching other people and staring out the window and fantasizing. And I often get down on myself if I'm not turning out 10 pages a day.
Right. This is extremely obvious, but I was also just delighted at how funny and well-written Stephen King's On Writing was.
Oh, it's so funny.
It's just, like, so concisely written and delightful. I was like, this is amazing.
I was at a bookstore the other day, and I bought the version from way back when the cover was, like, a picture of a clapboard house. Now the picture is him in his office, and he has a little corgi. And I think the fact that Stephen King has a corgi is just hilarious, because it's so precious, and, like, he's so dark, but also hilarious, and it's great.
Yeah.
He's so smart. I happened to be watching television the other day, and this movie from this late 70s, early 80s, called Christine came on, which is about a car that is evil and comes to life and kills people. And I had never heard of it or seen it. But it's just as a sort of allegory of the American obsession with automobiles. It's just, like, so great. And I think he does get a lot of credit. He's a smart guy. I love him.
And then, have you seen anything else recently that you'd like to recommend?
Ooh, let's see. The season just started. I'll tell you what I want to see. Signature is doing the Susan Laurie Parks season, which is actually going to be amazing.
Yeah, I want to see all of those shows.
There's also a new, like, Willino play, a new Annie Baker play, some great stuff. Simon McBurney from Complicité has a piece on Broadway called The Encounter.
Okay.
Which sounds fantastic. I really want to see that. What else? Oh, I guess, and Everything at BAM Next Wave.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This was a delight. A delight. Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller. Music by Brendan Spieth. Audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suf's has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.